Welcome to Season 5 of the Big Sci-Fi Podcast with Adina, Brian, Chris, and Steve, the biggest sci-fi podcast in the galaxy. The adventure is just beginning here at the Big Sci-Fi Podcast, and we invite you to come aboard the Starship Tangent. We know you'll enjoy the conversation, the laughter, the banter back and forth, and most of all, friends who love hanging out to talk about all things science fiction. Set your phasers to fun. Here we go.
Welcome, listeners, to an extraordinary episode of our podcast, where we're thrilled to have the chance to chat with award-winning and New York Times bestselling author David Mack. David's illustrious career includes more than 36 novels, the most recent of which is one coming out out as of February 27, 2024, called Firewall, which tells the tale of Seven of Nine and how she became a Fenris Ranger. So after Voyager, but before Picard. But before we dive into the cosmic depths of our conversation, a quick reminder to all of our incredible listeners. Please don't forget to like, review, and share our podcast on your preferred platform. Your support helps us to continue to bring you these stellar discussions. And now back to David, whose work not only includes pivotal episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but also contributions as a consultant to the animated series Star Trek Lower Decks and Star Trek Prodigy. His writing has garnered a critical acclaim and a dedicated fan base, thanks to his ability to weave complex narratives that explore the very fabric of the Star Trek ethos. His passion for storytelling and deep understanding of the Star Trek universe have made significant impacts on both the series and its audience. So join us as we explore the universe through David's eyes, discussing everything from his early rejections to his most recent achievements. David, welcome to our show.
I'm glad to be here, and that's a heck of an introduction. Thank you.
And she was being so modest with you.
That was one heck of an introduction. I'm honored. Thank you.
My goal is to embarrass our guests.
I'm very hard to embarrass. 36 years in New York, hard to embarrass. Easy to flatter, hard to embarrass.
Awesome. Well, how did you just, you know, I want to start at the beginning of how did you get into writing in general? And then how did you get into writing Star Trek? You know, where did it begin?
I mean, I pretty much was always a writer, a storyteller at heart, going all the way back to childhood. My folks used to like to tell stories of, you know, as a kid, I would stay up late at night, in my room with the little black and white TV. And I would watch things like the Pink Panther movies that were in reruns at the time. And I could come out to breakfast the next morning, having seen one of these movies once, and I could recount the plot start to finish. And I could tell you everything that happened in the movie. Apparently, my brain was wired for story right from the beginning. So I always loved stories. I loved storytelling, particularly visual media like TV and film. I got the bug to start trying to put words on paper probably around maybe the age of 8 or 9. I started having these daydreams of, you know, I would draw book covers and I'd come up with imaginary titles and put my name on a byline because there was nothing I loved more than books as a kid. Loved to collect them, loved to read them. When I was really small, I loved to have my mom read them to me. But some of the best times I had, like on weekends, you know, she would go to run errands, buying groceries and whatnot. And rather than have to tote me around all day, she figured out she could trust the librarians with me. And she would just drop me off at the town library, put me down in the kids section. And the librarians would make sure I didn't wander off or, you know, go staggering into traffic. But there was a little chance of that because once I'm in a quiet, comfy place with a whole bunch of books, I wasn't going anywhere. She had to drag me out of there every time. Because I found, you know, all the great Sunday editions of like all the color Peanuts comics. So I could like read 50 years of Charlie Brown comics. Then I found the science fiction book section. And I started reading like the kids' YA science fiction books. I still remember, I think one of the first sci-fi books I ever read was called The Space Eagle. Maybe not a great work of literature, but it caught my imagination. And I must have read it 3-4 times. I found Planet of the Apes eventually as I got older and the movie novelizations of those, the Star Trek logs by Alan Dean Foster, all kinds of stuff. And then eventually found like original works like Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle. And then my brother started loaning me his Andre Norton novels. But Mm-hmm. So always, always in love with words, in love with books, right from the very beginning, and dreaming of seeing my name on a book around, you know, somewhere around the age of like 9, 10, 11 was when I started having that daydream, with only a sort of a detour starting around age 15, where I suddenly got the bug for screenwriting. That was what led me into film school and writing for TV. So I wrote for TV first, professionally. My first professional credit writing fiction for money was TV. So
and what series was that, if you don't
mind? Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Oh, wow. Very good.
That was my breakthrough when I was 26.
That is a big breakthrough to be able to walk into something like it wasn't like you started writing, you know, for something small, but that's...
I broke through on, you know, from out of the slush pile into a pitch meeting. You know, I basically got that 1 in 10,000 shot. You know, the one they tell you is impossible, that you're never going to get, you know, it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. They discourage everybody. They tell you, don't dream the impossible dream. Yeah, I did it 3 times.
That's amazing.
So, nice. Then that was what launched me. It was a sail to Voyager and then sails to DS9 with my then writing partner, John Ordover.
Okay.
That breakthrough into TV eventually opened the doors to writing for Star Trek in book form. And after, mm-hmm. you know, we'd spent a number of years pitching to TV, unable to replicate some of those early successes, I'd been making money in the Star Trek books office doing editorial work, helping with things like rejecting slush manuscripts, writing reference materials for the Star Trek authors, people like Peter David, Michael Jan Friedman.
Okay.
Helping to flesh out books that came up short. Like I wrote a chapter for John Vorenholt, Genesis Wave Book 1. And then after that, you know, when I pulled that off on short turnaround time, they offered me a book around, say, the year 2000. After I'd been working for them as sort of an office dog's body for about 5 years, I got offered the Starfleet Survival Guide. That was my first book. Got the contract, wrote the book. They said, okay, you can finish your book. Would you like to start pitching fiction? I said, sure. They said, well, we'll start you out on the ebooks, which was at that time something that they were doing that not a lot of people were doing, was a monthly ebook Star Trek novella, the Star Trek Corps of Engineers series. So they were doing monthly original ebooks, and I sort of jumped in on that. Started my first couple that I sold. It was a two-parter I wrote with my buddy Keith R.A. DeCandido, who at that point was already establishing himself pretty well as a novelist. And he helped me sort of get, you know, my feet wet and helped me understand the transition from writing scripts to writing prose. The, you know, helped me get the hang of the change of format, the difference in approach, the difference in perspective and point of view. Whereas in film, you're writing pretty much in this external point of view, the camera, it's very character neutral. When you write prose, you have to be in the head of a particular character in each sort of scene, because it is through the perceptions of the character that we really experience story. So novel writing is a very different animal, and he kind of helped me get the hang of that. Eventually, I wrote my own two-parter called Wildfire. That one took off, got great critical acclaim, sold really well. And based on that, I got invited up to the major leagues. You know, I got basically, I was like a minor league pitcher getting recruited up to the majors. Somebody just like dropped out on our big 9-book project for the fall next year. We have 2 book slots open back to back, books 7 and 8 of the A Time 2 series. Do you want to step in at the last minute and pick these up? I was like, I'll take it. Sure. I'll come in. Of course, at the time, I had just gotten engaged. I was moving out of my apartment, moving in with my wife, coming out here to Queens. So my whole life was in it. And I just started a new job within like the last few years. So I'm like, my whole life is in a state of upheaval. And this is when I'm agreeing to write my first 2 full-length novels back to back. And I'm trying to finish them both before I get married. But I did it. And one of them hit the USA Today list. And I've been writing for Star Trek and other franchises and my own original stuff ever since, 20 years now.
Wow.
That's amazing.
So when you first got, you know, that first break into Deep Space Nine, like at that point, what would your level of fandom in Star Trek be? Because you were describing, you know, that you were very into books. Mm-hmm. Were you also really watching the show growing up?
Are,
and
are you kidding? Yeah. I grew up with Star Trek. I mean, I was born just too late to see it in first run because I would have been an infant. I was born like maybe about a month before the series ended on TV, but it went into syndicated reruns. And so, you know, I got planted in front of the TV, and in addition to Sesame Street, Electric Company, Villa Alegre, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, there was also Star Trek. And, you know, as I like to say, I was like a duckling that imprints on the first moving thing it sees. And for me, that was Star Trek. Star Trek was the first major sci-fi franchise that found its way into my imagination and into my heart, and it imprinted, and I imprinted on it. And so the ethos of Star Trek, of humanity bonded together in friendship, the ideals of peace being better than war, better to create than to destroy, better to, you know, build bonds of friendship than, you know, try to oppress or colonize. These are the ideals that I grew up with and which, you know, sort of formed my worldview right from the beginning. So I watched every episode of the original series of Trek multiple times. I'd probably seen them all like 20 times by the time Star Trek the Motion Picture came out in 79. Went to see that, devoured that. You know, sure, they say now it was slow and had these problems and those problems. I don't care. I loved it. I'm sitting there, I'm watching V'ger. I don't even care that it's basically the episode The Changeling just revised and written much bigger. I don't care. It's just awesome. I mean, there's Vulcan with that huge thing, and there's, you know, the Spock with the Kolinar thing, and V'ger, and then, you know, Ilea and the light. I don't care. I loved it. So, you know, I saw all the Star Trek movies. And then Star Trek The Next Generation began just as I was starting film school. So here I am, you know, I'm learning to write scripts. I love Trek. Here's Next Gen. And starting in season two, Next Gen creates the open door script submission policy where they invite young writers and of all kinds to say, if you got an idea and you can execute it as a script, not just story ideas, not a pitch, but a finished script, you can send it in on spec if you sign the waiver. So I started submitting scripts. I would work on them. I'd have my friends read them. I figure I'm in film school. I'm being taught screenwriting. Why not put it to use? Never broke through. Never got out of the slush pile at Next Gen. That was many years of throwing things at the wall, collecting rejections. You could never have more than one script on submission at a time. So I just kept collecting the rejections. And then this continued. DS9 had the same policy when it started. So I continued sending scripts. Now I'm sending scripts to DS9. And originally I sent some of my own. I sent some with a different writing partner who I worked with briefly. And you know, we kind of hit a lot of brick walls. And I realized I wasn't quite getting the traction I needed. I couldn't figure out why none of these things were getting traction. The one thing that I was not big into in terms of fandom, I was never big into conventions. Didn't go to a lot of conventions. I went to a few as a kid, but that was more about my interest in role-playing games. I went to find like the cool 30-sided dice. I went to find the cool figures, you know, for wasn't there. I was there more for RPGs and gaming than I was for fandom itself. But then, you know, here I am. I'm trying to break into Trek. I'm living in New York City. It's 1992, I think, maybe 93, somewhere in there. And I see that there is going to be a science fiction convention a short walk from where I live. At the time, I lived in Hell's Kitchen, which is like the West 40s in Manhattan, over by the Hudson River. And at one of the hotels around, like, maybe, I think, 7th
Penn Station.
Avenue, across from Penn Station. Yeah, that one. Kind of a big creation con sort of a thing. And I see, like, a couple of the guests who are going to be there doing, like, a discussion thing. They say they're going to have Ron Moore, Brandon Braga, and script coordinator Lolita Faggio there to talk to you to tell people about how to write for Star Trek on TV. I'm like, oh, now that sounds like useful information that I could really dig into. Except I've never been to a convention. I don't know you're supposed to buy tickets in advance. Nobody tells
Surprise!
Me these things. I figure, you know, the last time I went to a con for RPG, I was a kid. It was at UMass. I just walked in, you walked around, you bought dice, you walked out. I didn't know. Nobody tells me these things. So at the time, I had a job. I'd gotten out of college. I was working in publishing, working for magazine publishing. So I went down there thinking, well, this is a professional situation for me. I treated it like any other. At the time, you know, I was young. I was a lot thinner than I am now. I had nice dark hair. I was clean shaven. And I walked in. I was wearing my suit, nice dark suit, white shirt, crisp tie, polished shoes, long trench coat. I'm carrying my briefcase with some of my scripts in it. I walk in, and I zero in on a guy wearing a shirt that says convention security. And I walk right up to the guy and I go, excuse me, I'm looking for Lolita Faggio, Brandon Braga, and Ron Moore. Do you know where they are, please? And he goes, oh, yes, sir. They're right in there. They're in the ballroom. You can go right in. Thank you. And I walk right by him. I go in the ballroom. The ballroom is empty. The event hasn't started yet.
Oh, my goodness.
Lolita, Brandon, and Ron Moore are at the end by the big table, just kind of hanging out, shooting the breeze between the three of them. I walk right up. I'm standing there like I'm just waiting for a chance to jump into the conversation. I'm picking up things by osmosis. We say hi. I say hi. We shake hands. We start talking. We start talking about script writing and Trek and, you know, what are they working on? How are things going? And, you know, and then I start asking them questions. And then I mention, you know, I've got these scripts. I've been collecting these rejections. And they all kind of stop and they look at each other. And they look at me and they go, you're not the lawyer from Paramount, are you? I said, I never claimed that I was.
You just I'm looked the
back.
Part.
I'm here because I want to learn to write the Star part. Trek. And they were like, oh, I'm crying out loud. At this point, Brannon is just fed up. He walks away mumbling curses under his breath.
Oh, man.
He's got no time to talk to me. But Lolita and Ron were very nice. And they said, okay. They said, you know, what kind of stories have you been submitting that got rejected? And I would tell them. And I'd describe one. And Ron sort of took it apart. He says, all right, here's what I'm hearing. He says, you know, you're working on this. You're thinking in very first level idea. You're thinking about the concept, but you're not thinking about what it says about a character's life. Mm. So you got to ground the story in how it's affecting the character. The character must be undergoing a personal story that is reflected in the concept story. The two have to work together. One should illuminate the other.
Oh, interesting.
I go, now that's useful. He goes, good luck. Take this information, go forth and rewrite. And so I did. And I left. And I left the con and went home and had this new knowledge. Eventually got a new writing partner, took this new approach and applied it. And about 2 years later, you know, we'd made our sales to Voyager and DS9. And we came out in August of 95 to do the break session, which is when you go into the writer's room. And you take the story, which at this point is just a few pages of narrative in simple prose, and you turn it into a scene-by-scene breakdown of how you're going to write the script. This is the teaser, the cold open. This is how many scenes. This is what each scene is. This is the stinger. This is how we're going to end the act and go to commercial on cliffhanger here. Here's how we pick up at the top of Act One. And you go through and you basically work with the room. And you break down the whole script and you find the structure of the whole thing. When it's done and everybody agrees on it, the assistant writes it up. You go home and you write your script and you got 2 weeks to turn it in. Huh. So my buddy John and I, we go out for the break session. And we walk into the Paramount offices, which at that time were in the Star Trek offices, which were on the Paramount lot in the Hart building. As we're walking into the writer's room, as you walk in at that time, you'd pass by the desk of the script coordinator, Lolita Faggio. And as I'm walking by to go into the meeting, she looks up and she goes, you're familiar. She goes, I know you. We've met. I go, yeah. Yeah, we've met. She thinks and she goes, don't tell me. New York. 2 years ago, you're the one who came to the con. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, that was me. Yeah.
And she goes, you made it. I go, I made
That's
it.
That's fantastic.
Good for you.
Nice.
That's really great. Great story. That's great.
That's a very different experience than I had at those creation conventions in New York City. I went to a lot of them from 1998 to early 92 when I left New York to for Marilyn, but I was usually there to see the actors because I wasn't yet thinking about, you know, writing. And I never thought about, you know, I never thought about script writing. So that would not have been something I that would have keyed on. But that's a fascinating story.
Yeah, I was never all that interested in meeting actors.
Right. Well, fair enough. That's it. Just, you know, so I was still a teenager at the time and kind of like, you know, in that starstruck, you know, mode. And especially when I got to see people, you know, and again, similar to you, I was born I'm a couple years younger than you, but I was born after the original Star Trek, but grew up watching it, you know, very religiously in syndication. So like, you know, these people, you know, like DeForest Kelly is a presence in my house. And I still remember going to see him at a Creation convention, just like, again, awestruck that this person who I have seen as Dr. McCoy my entire life, you know, I know him just as well as I know my parents, is like standing there in front of me, you know, like, what do I do? I don't know.
Believe it, I understand that when we were on the Paramount lot doing the break session, we would break for lunch. And John and I went over to the commissary to, you know, get a bite to eat. Place is bustling. There's nowhere to sit. We're trying to find any place to sit down. And the only available seats are at a table with George Takei.
Oh, wow.
And we didn't want to impose, but he saw that we were at a loss. And he's like, do you need a place to sit? We're like, would that be okay, Mr. Takei? And he's like, please join me. Okay. We said that we had lunch with George Takei.
How very fantastic. Nice.
Lovely.
On the way back from the commissary, we run into Jonathan Frakes, and we talk to Jonathan Frakes. And I'm like, this is incredible. I want to live like this all the time. I didn't get to live all the time, but it's cool for a couple of days.
Right. Well, I'd like to know if you're willing to answer. I don't know if you have a favorite, but is there a favorite Trek series in particular that you just fell in love with?
The ones that have been on TV, it's hard to rank them. I mean, I love all of them in their own way. Obviously, I think if I've got a favorite, it's got to be DS9. And not just because I wrote for DS9, but because I loved its approach to the Star Trek universe. Mm-hmm. I would say it's probably number one. Second place right now is like a close tie, TOS and TNG. TOS, because it's the template. It's where it all began. It's what I grew up with. I know that some younger viewers maybe don't cotton to it because it doesn't feel like something they can relate to as a product of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. But it's what I grew up with. It's what I understand. And I can see how Star Trek evolved from that.
Right.
And then, of course, TNG, because that was what really escalated Star Trek and brought it to a much broader fandom and made possible everything that has followed. And TNG, although it had a shaky start, some of those early seasons were a little, you know, weak at times.
Sure.
Eventually, when it found its footing, when it got going, it was brilliant. You know, there was some great work done there. So it's iconic. So those two like are definitely tied in second place in my sort of personal estimation. Strange New Worlds bumping right up right now at number three. It's like right there in third place.
Yes, sir.
You know, and the only reason it's not escalating into second is that it's only had two seasons.
Right.
Let it get a couple more seasons and hey, you know, it might bump its way up and either TOS or TNG may have to come down a peg. Right behind that, Prodigy. Prodigy's great. And I say that not just because I worked on it and made all kinds of behind-the-scenes contributions, but because the Hageman brothers and their writing team truly created something wonderful.
Yeah.
And then after that, everything else kind of tied after that in a big jumble. Picard would probably be slightly ahead of Discovery for me, both of which I'd put ahead of Lower Decks. And you know, then there's
I love Lower Decks so much.
Then there's Voyager, and then there's Enterprise.
See, I am TNG is my sentimental favorite. It's what I started Trek in, and then went back, then started watching the original because the original was first on Saturday nights, and then TNG in the Cleveland area here. But Deep Space Nine is by far. And our other co-host, Chris, who's not here, we're kind of on the same page. DS9 was just so different, and they lost occasionally, which was so intriguing to me. watching that. And so I agree with you. Steve, on the other hand, Enterprise is at the top of his list.
And you have to understand, David, I watched Star Trek live. I started watching September the 8th, 1966. Man. And the reason why I love Enterprise is because, and this is my strange way of saying, it seems to be the most realistic in that there is the transition from NASA to Enterprise, and they made Enterprise look like it was actually built. You had manufacturer labels on everything. The people didn't know what they were explorers, they're learning. And a lot of the actions that took place in the series harken back to my love of growing up during the NASA program of the 1960s. It just seemed to follow that. Again, it is probably, you know, when you came out, it broke all the rules of what Star Trek was supposed to be. Didn't have Star Trek in the name, had an opening song, a lot of things that were not what it's supposed to be. But I really love it. I've said this.
Nothing wrong with that.
Too many times is that I was burnt out after Voyager, after so much Star Trek, and that show rekindled my love of the show. But that's not to say they're all good. And like you said,
they all have something to offer.
Strange yes. New Worlds, it's like a joy.
Yes.
And this last season was full of just wonderful terrific. Episodes.
The cast has amazing chemistry.
Oh, they
the show
really
looks great. The writers are just on fire.
Yeah.
I mean, with only like maybe the occasional slight teensy misstep here and there, like the one episode that was clearly just a riff on The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, very heavy-handed and not particularly well done.
Mm-hmm.
But I forgive it because the rest of the show is just so damn good.
Yeah,
yes.
I was thrilled to be in that room.
Yeah.
Right. Are you kidding me? I mean, right now I'm just agitating to try and get a Strange New Worlds novel, you know, as my next assignment. So.
Yeah. You had said something a minute ago about, you know, younger viewers not necessarily getting into original series. Now, I don't know what your involvement has been in Lower Decks, and I do want to ask about that.
One.
Cool. Okay. So one of the best things about Lower Decks is I watched that with my 13-year-old, and that has given me a lot of openings to be like, oh, you want to understand that bit? We got to go watch this original series or TNG episode. And then he will actually sit there and watch the episode with me.
Okay.
So
it's an excuse to sort of introduce them to the more classic element. Mm-hmm. So that they can finally understand that they have no grasp of continuity or canon at Lower Decks.
They're just having fun. So much fun. I mean,
which I wouldn't object
to, so
but they didn't also insist on calling themselves canon. If they just wanted to be satirical, then I would say do whatever the hell you want and go for the joke at all expense. But don't call yourself canon if you don't realize that the M116 creature has been extinct for 114 fucking years.
Well, here's the thing, David. When Lower Decks came on and I watched the first episode, I went, this is horrible. This is not Star Trek. This is horrible. Oh, my God.
I loved it so much.
And then months later, I went back and watched it again, and I went, wait a minute. This is satire. This is funny. Oh, wow. Now I get the joke.
Satire. It's a fine distinction. But
I'm so indifferent to Lower Decks. I don't watch it. I'm fine without it. But I know others love it.
I watch it because it's my job to watch it.
Right. Okay.
So, I have to know all the continuity of all the shows.
Wow.
Because I have to see how they all weave and fit together. Because when I'm working in tie-in material, I have to know the whole universe. I can't afford to be ignorant of a particular corner of the universe. So I may not have loved Enterprise, but I had to watch it. I may not have loved every minute of Voyager, but I had to watch it. And I sometimes have to go back and rewatch it.
Yeah.
I think that's a good segue to talk about the recent book. Firewall.
Absolutely.
So how did that come about? You know, again, as tie-in fiction, we recently just saw the most amazing season of Picard. We are all beyond in love with Seven, way more than, you know, people were before. And yeah, so she has this backstory of she was a Fenris Ranger. But there's not a lot of detail about that in Picard. And now you have this book. So how did that, what was the genesis for the book?
Well, it started basically when, I think probably back in 2020, when the episode Stardust City Rag first aired. And I remember, you know, they were dropping episode week by week. And so they have Seven of Nine appear at the end of Picard season one, ep four, is where she saves their butts and they beam her out. They say the words Fenris Ranger and you see Seven of Nine, but you don't really get much more about it till the following episode. And they give you a little bit, but not, again, not a whole bunch more, but they give enough of it that I'm watching Stardust City Rag. And I pause in the middle of watching the episode for the very first time so that I can pick up my phone and immediately email my editor. I want to write a Fenris Rangers novel. And with about 3 minutes, she replies. It's the middle of the night, but she's awake. So she replies within about 3 minutes, you and everybody else.
Oh, really?
But she said, you know, no, there's a current moratorium. The folks at Secret Hideout, the people who produce the new run of shows, at that time, we're saying that, you know, it had to be hands off for things like Fenris Rangers and the new continuity, because they weren't sure yet what they intended to do with it. They wanted to leave it open and untouched so that if, say, in season two or season three, if in the course of working in the writer's room, a storyline that had, you know, springs up involving the Fenris Rangers, they didn't want to be beholden to anything that had been done, say, in the books, and they didn't want to be in the position of having to overwrite our continuity, which they would gladly do in a heartbeat, but they didn't want there to be this apparent disconnect. They wanted to make sure that the books that were being produced and are still being produced are in harmony with what they are doing, but they are in the lead and we are in the follow. So until they say, okay, we're done playing with this toy, you may now play with this toy, we don't get to play with the toy.
Interesting.
So I was told, hands off the Fenris Rangers toy and go do something else. So I did something else for a couple of years. And around the end of 2021, I went out to lunch with my editors, or maybe it was the end of 2022, somewhere in there. And went out to lunch and we were talking about this and that and the other thing. And they said, so how would you like to write the story of Seven of Nine joins the Fenris Rangers? I said, would I? Well, I think so. I got tapped for that gig by the editors and they said, go off, go thou and write a proposal, write a pitch. And the way that currently works is I came up with a general idea, the shape of the story, kept it relatively concise. And the editors, I tune it until the editors like it. Then the editors run it past my friend Kirsten Beyer. Kirsten Beyer is one of the co-creators of Star Trek Picard. Okay. She's currently a co-executive producer with the Secret Hideout team, working her way up through the ranks. One role she fills specifically for them is she is the liaison between Secret Hideout and the tie-in publishing arm at Simon & Schuster and at IDW Comics. And so she has to vet or approve anything that's based on the new Secret Hideout versions of Trek. So if it's old, if it's classic legacy Trek, you know, if it's like next gen DS9, TOS, it doesn't have to go through Kirsten. But if it's Picard, Discovery, Strange New Worlds, Kirsten has to sign off.
Interesting.
On it. That's her job. So I got to work with Kirsten, which is always a joy because she and I have collaborated on things before, and she has just the most amazing sense of story, how to tighten things up, how to knit things together. She's able to see where the problems lie. She's able to sort of help refocus things so that everything works together thematically. And so I got her feedback on the story, and that shaped it and, you know, sort of influenced the direction that the final narrative took. And once I had her approval and her buy-in, we were good to go. I got the green light, and then it was just a matter of, you know, getting the manuscript written despite all the roadblocks that life threw in front of me.
How about how long did it take you to write this book, and on average, how long does it take?
Well, I mean, if you look at actual days I spent writing, it didn't take me that much longer than it usually does. I usually write a tie-in novel like this in about 10 to 12 weeks.
Okay.
What caused the delays were just things like life getting in the way. I can't start working on the manuscript until the powers that be, in this case, Kirsten, give you the green light. And until mm-hmm. that happens, you're basically on hold. So you go and you work on other things. Gotcha. Then you get the green light. And I was, you know, I had to clear the decks. I had things going on. I had a couple projects I had to finish first. My plan originally was going to be that I was going to spend the month of May last year. You know, that was when I was really going to dig in and start working on the book in earnest. Mm-hmm. And then on May 4th, my wife's father died. Mm-hmm. And the whole month of May just vanished.
Right.
Suddenly she's got to go to Texas, and she's shuttling between Texas and Illinois, where he's going to be buried. There's things to deal with the family. I'm coordinating her travel. Eventually I'm going to have to join her. I got to find a cat sitter. I got to find someone to take care of the house. You know, there's just, there's issues of cost and expense and logistics and travel and all these other things. And it just ate the whole month.
Right.
And sure. By the time I looked up and was able to breathe again, you know, it was June, and I had a couple of conventions I had to do. And so I was trying to get some, you know, momentum again. And I finally get to work in around mid-June is when I finally am able to, like, you know, clear the decks. I've gotten all my responsibilities handled. I set to work and I started hitting a good pace. I got my rhythm going. And I had planned to finish. I think I had a hard deadline. The manuscript had to be in, I think, by August 21 was the hard delivery date. And I was cruising toward finishing maybe, you know, as much as maybe a week early. And I was, you know, about a week out from finishing the book, feeling good. I've got my momentum. And I got COVID.
Oh, my.
Ooh.
And when I say I got COVID, I mean, I got the kind of COVID where my first day I ended up in the ER and I nearly died. So I spent a nice long day in the ER, and then I spent about a week recovering. And so that just and then even after you've technically recovered,
right,
you feel wiped out. Mm-hmm. I mean, COVID leaves you just feeling like a drained battery for weeks afterward. But I had to get the book done. So I somehow just as soon as I was even remotely able to work again, I just got back in there and I finished the final chapters. I believe I turned in the book about 4 hours ahead of my deadline.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
I did about, you made it.
Right across the finish line in time.
4 hours to spare.
Yeah.
But usually it takes me 10 to 12 weeks. And that was, again, roughly the same amount of writing time. It's just life kept getting in the way.
Yeah.
It took the same amount of time. It just got spread out over a longer period.
Now, can I ask you a selfish question? As an aspiring writer myself, who is got a couple just short stories that I'm really just deadlocked. Like I don't even feel almost the inspiration to work through just to sit down and just type something, do something to see if I can't get a good rhythm going. Is there anything you do, or do you just have to walk away for a time and then come back and see it with fresh eyes, or is there any practice you do just to push through that?
If you can't see the story, then maybe there's something wrong with it, and walking away can help give you a fresh perspective. Sometimes if a scene just refuses to happen, it could be a sign that you're writing it through the eyes of the wrong character. Try choosing a different perspective character. One of the keys to figuring out who should be your point of view in any given scene, it should always be the character who has the most to lose in that scene. Whoever has the most at stake, whoever's going to be the most emotionally involved, that's usually the best person to choose as your POV character, unless you need to withhold information by using a different character. Beyond that, my only other advice, what's worked for me over 20 years, I drink. I subscribe to the write drunk, edit sober philosophy. I drink less.
Adina?
I used to go through like maybe a couple of double
Dina. I don't drink at all. I can't drink at all anymore. Since I hit that age, certain age of a certain woman, alcohol does not agree with me anymore. I haven't had a drink in a long time.
Yeah, alcohol can put me to sleep pretty fast now at my age. It basically a switch flipped for me about maybe in the last 2 years. Used to be I could put away a couple of doubles of whiskey and ginger ale, whatever, over the course of a night and write two scenes. Now, if I try to do that, I'm asleep in my chair with the computer on, and I'll lose, 3-4 hours, and then I'll wake up and I'll have done not much. I can have maybe a drink if I nurse it. If I try to do two drinks, I'm down for the night.
Yeah. Darn you, metabolism.
Darn metabolism. Liver function shutting down after the
Yep. So I'm the creature of habit. Remember, I do. I write by habit. No matter what, but I get to, but for Brian, you know, if I'm not feeling it, move on to something else. Or I like David's suggestion of switching around. Maybe it's a different character you need to think about, or maybe really it's not the right scene or not the right story in the moment and such, but no, habit gets it done.
Yeah, habit gets it done. And there's all sorts of other tricks, like aside from changing the character point of view. Sometimes, you know, you get jammed up because something doesn't feel emotionally honest, and that's why you're not engaging with it. Sometimes the key is to say, all right, what if we do the opposite? You're trying to write a love scene and the characters just don't seem to click. All right. At the moment where you think they were supposed to kiss, she slaps them across the face. It's like,
that's a good one.
That's a,
it's like
definitely a juxtaposed position.
Even if it leads to a dead end, at the very least, if it breaks the logjam and gets you putting words on the page again,
right. Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Another technical writing question I have for you, that specifically for writing in the Star Trek universe, how do you come up with names of individuals that are not human species?
Great question.
Because you know, we might come across a species like the Zach Dorn in like one episode in Star Trek, but now you're writing and they're showing up in your novels, and I notice they show up in Keith's novels and Dayton's novels. How do you come up with names that fit, given when you have like one or two, maybe three examples to work from?
Well, I mean, sometimes you extrapolate. For instance, they establish a Zaktor name, they've got, what's his name? Something Kolrami or something?
Kolrami. Yeah.
I can't remember what his first name
performance.
Is. Yeah, but they they established he had a first name, something Kolrami. And so there's a cadence to the name. So I remember naming one of my Zaktor characters Grun Helkara. I think I have one. I have another Zaktor character coming up in Firewall. I try to find like the cadence that already exists for the character names, and I either find something with a similar cadence or a similar structure. I noticed, for instance, you know, when you're dealing with Vulcans, they tend to be two syllable names a lot of the time, with a couple of rare exceptions. You see male characters very often tend to have names that start with S and have some sort of, you know, K or R or V. And then they started establishing things like the T apostrophe name convention for female Vulcan characters. So a lot of writers went and ran with that. And then eventually in tie-in, you know, you start running out of good options that other people haven't already used. So you have to start extrapolating and say, well, if you can use T apostrophe, why can't you use something else? And I hit upon L apostrophe, which worked just fine. I came up with Lahan, L-H-A-A-N. It looks perfectly Vulcan to my eye. It sounds right. And it fits their convention. And if you can name a character Valeris or Savik, then you can use any other variety. Savik, it's actually a little, it's kind of Norse. You know, it's not that far off from names you'd actually find in Norway or Sweden. So if suddenly I'm looking to different sources. But for instance, you know, when I need to come up with names across the course of a book, I have like, you know, my style. Like, I know the approach I'm going to take to a Boldian name, the approach I'll take if I need to name a Vulcan, a Klingon, a Zach Dorn, etc. I have a particular style I like to use, you know, for Trill and other characters. But across the whole sort of the book, lately I've been doing more kind of a themed approach. Whereas if you go through, for instance, Oblivion's Gate, book 3 of the Coda trilogy, you begin to find, if you look at all the place names and the names of things like the black holes that they go to, and you start looking up what are the sources of these names, where do they come from, you find that a lot of it is tied into apocalyptic mythology. When we're going through Firewall, because I was asked to write a book about the Fenris Rangers, who are named after the Fenris Wolf, which is part of Norse mythology, I chose to go with a lot of Norse names. And I basically had a map of Norway. Whenever I needed a place name, I'd go and scan it till I found something that looked good. So you got a planet called Skanavik Prime. Skanovic is a town in Norway.
Very interesting.
And so on. And I pulled a lot of, and some of those names made good character names, so I pulled them out when I needed them. So there's a very Norse flavor to a lot of the place names and many of the character names throughout the Seven of Nine book, throughout Firewall. And there's even sort of a little cultural touch from the point of view of a character named Keon Harper, who's a Fenris Ranger, who I sort of picture as being like Jeff Bridges in The Old Man. And there's a scene where he's made a terrible miscalculation. He's trying to do something on his own, and he's basically blundered into an ambush, and he's about to get killed, and he's thinking to himself, I have just made the fatal last mistake of my life, and I'm going to die. And he would have, except for the fact that that's the moment that Seven, who was told to observe and not engage, chooses to engage anyway, because she thinks, what would Janeway think of me if I just stand here and watch this guy die? And so she comes out, guns blazing, and saves his ass. And when he sees her coming, he can't help it. He looks at her, and what he sees from his point of view, it's described as a tall blonde Valkyrie, you know, wielding a pair of Stinger pistols, comes out, you know, blazing. And he's seeing her as a Valkyrie, which, again, a very Norse reference. Mm-hmm. But if you also know what the symbolism of the Valkyrie is, they're not supposed to be warrior women. They're the spirits. They're basically angelic figures that escort the spirits of the dead into the next life. They are what are known as psychopomps. And so this is actually a foreshadowing, spoiler alert, this is a foreshadowing of the fate that awaits poor Keon Harper. And we see other, you know, inklings of this, other foreshadowing moments that tell you he's sort of on a path to, you know, a sad end. But, you know, it begins with this Norse imagery of the Valkyrie.
That's fascinating.
So another, that's really cool. Another related question. I'm going to maybe step back also when you're writing, you know, you're writing characters for this book. Do you personally have any methodology for choosing the species a character is going to be, or does it just like organically happen? Like, you know, you have a Trill, you have a Zakdorn, and I keep hitting on the Zakdorn because I feel like I don't see that very often. So the, you know, so the Zakdorn sticks in my brain.
I mean, like I had the Zakdorn that I used in Firewall. I think his name was Lenniker Zega. Spoiler alert, he dies early. I try to mix it up. Like I try not to use too many of the same character. I try not to let the universe get too human heavy, for one thing. That was always one of those things where TOS era is very human heavy, and so other writers, you know, Dayton Ward and Kevin Del Moore and James Swallow and I, we leaned into that when we were working on, say, the Vanguard books, which are set in that era. And so we made those books more human heavy because that was what felt like TOS. But even there, we were trying to expand the repertoire beyond them. We, you know, we try to get a little bit of variety, especially because we don't have to worry about makeup budgets, costume budgets, special effects budgets. We can have whoever the hell we want. So I try to get in, you know, I throw in a mix. Bad guys, I've got Antikins, I've got Baldux, I've got Kaunoth.
The Antikin, yes, yeah, that was the other one. You know, we look like
dogs. I've got the Chalnoth. I've got, you know, I've got everybody I want. You know, I can put in a Gorn if I want to. I just got to be careful about Gorn and continuity now that Strange New Worlds is reinventing the Gorn.
Yes.
but, you know, with, for instance, my sort of primary cast, again, I just wanted to mix it up. So I know I've got Seven of Nine, who is nominally human, but she's also ex-Borg. And then so I pair her up with Keon Harper, who I decide is going to be human, and I make him, you know, white. We've got her love interest, Ellery Cade, and rather than have another human in the mix, I decide to make her Trill, and I pattern her after Jessica Henwick. So I'm thinking, okay, so kind of like her. And then their sort of surrounding troop of other Fenris Rangers, you know, I've got a Cardassian or half Cardassian woman. I've got a Bajoran guy named Jalen Parr. We've got a guy named Lucan Sagasta, who is nominally human, but could be Argelian. Who the hell knows? We've got a guy named Spears, who's pretty clearly human. We've got Andorians in the mix. We've got Saurians. We've got, you know, What's Saru's species? The Kelpians. We got Kelpians in the mix. There's like a half-human, half-Klingon who happens to be within the Fenris Rangers. The Fenris Rangers will basically take anybody who wants to sign up. They're not particularly picky. So I try to get at least a sense of diversity, a sense of range in the cast. If for no other reason, it helps me to come up with names that are significantly different from one another. So that, Jalen Parr, that sounds like a good Bajoran name.
Yes, it does.
And then you've got, Lucan Sagasta. You're not going to mix up on a page. Like, once you've gotten a good intro for Lucan Sagasta, who's basically got dark brown skin and a bright white Cheshire Cat smile, and he basically is the hotspur, the young hotshot of the group who's got away with the ladies. You're not going to mix him up with, stiff Jalen Parr or, go, go, go commando Spears over here. Once you get the name Spears, you got Sagasta, you got Parr, you've got Cage, you've got Harper. You can start telling these people apart very quickly. And that's part of why it helps to have different species, different sounding names. I try to, be aware of the reader needs to be able to quickly parse who these people are. I need to be able to establish the character traits quickly. And it also helps if the names are distinct enough from one another that even if you're just scanning the page, you're not going to get lost.
Yeah, I got a very Han Solo-y kind of vibe from Harper. Like if Han Solo was a good guy, kind of.
Well, first of all, Han Solo is supposed to be a good guy. But
well, no, not good guy. But like if he was a member of a law enforcement agency.
Oh, I see. At least he wasn't a rogue.
Yeah. He wasn't rogue. Cops. Right. Yeah.
The Fenris Rangers at the beginning are
cops. Yeah.
Before they had generated into the anarchistic, sort of non-hierarchical entity that they become. The band of roving Robin Hoods, whatever that they've become 20 years later. This is set earlier when they are just beginning that evolution away from being a legitimate interstellar law enforcement patrol that, defends a sector of space into becoming this sort of freewheeling, anybody who wants to show up and bring a ship, hey, you're in. We don't even bother to have uniforms. They're not there yet. They are still a little more structured and regimented than that. But I wasn't really picturing, I guess it could be Han Solo, but I'm not picturing Jeff Bridges. I'm picturing Jeff
Bridges. Okay, sure.
He's got that sort of a Jeff Bridges draw, especially with lines like, kid, you talk too much.
He's got an amazing Jeff Bridges impersonation.
It's a good one.
And his recurring line through the book, when he'll tell Seven something she doesn't want to hear, and she'll call him and he'll say, "Truth or comfort, kid, you get one."
Yep. I like that. That's a good one,
David. Do you see multiple books coming out of these storylines that you've been going on about? I mean, do you want to flesh out other characters, maybe make them the main characters of future books about the adventures of the Rangers?
I don't particularly see a need for that.
Okay.
I don't see a market for that. I think part of what is going to make this book marketable, if anything, is it's the fact that it's a coming-of-age story for Seven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there is a particular hunger out there for random stories about random Fenris Rangers.
Okay.
I mean, if they want to pay me to write them, I'll find a way, but what was compelling and interesting to me about telling this story is that it's about Seven at a time in her life. Voyager has just come back to Earth within about the last 2 years. And she's had this sort of emotional safety net with the crew of Voyager. They've been sort of helping to try and reintegrate her, help her reclaim her humanity step by step. And they provide a very sheltered environment in which she's been doing that. And then the moment they get home, they scatter because, Voyager is going to get put into museum status and they don't need a crew for that ship anymore. So Harry's off doing whatever Harry's going to be doing. Chakotay gets put in charge of the Protostar. The Doctor's off on his book tour. Tom and B'Elanna go off to have their kid. Tuvok gets sent to Starfleet Command, security, whatever. And Janeway's now in the Admiralty.
Right.
Everybody scatters. Seven has lost her entire found family in a shot, and now she's all alone. And so the only person she really has left who is in her life on a consistent basis is Janeway. Because, you know, once she comes back, the Federation doesn't know what to make of her. They are still only a few years out from the events of First Contact, where the Borg essentially walk right up to Earth. And from the point of view of Starfleet, who doesn't know that they briefly were wiped out of the timeline, but from their point of view, the Borg walked right up and nearly annihilated us. They are not on a good footing with the Borg, and they don't trust them. So when Janeway shows up and says, here's my friend 7 of 9, can you give her a Starfleet commission, please? It's not a big surprise when they go, no. No. She rebelled 3 times on your ship. She seized control. She assaulted your officers. She tried to return to the collective 3 times. And Janeway tries to explain, well, that's post-traumatic stress syndrome. She didn't know what she was doing. She's not like that anymore. Really? You want us to bet the safety of a capital ship on that? Are you sure? Mm-hmm. If I were an admiral, I'd have my doubts if I didn't know 7 of 9 personally. Mm-hmm. The problem is, of course, they've got this going on. And then the Federation itself has to be told, well, yes, we know that your records say Annika Hansen died, you know, 20 years ago at the age of 6, whatever. But, you know, here she is in the flesh. And can you reissue ID cards and bring her back to life? And they say, sure. Yeah, we can arrange that. And then she says, and my name is 7 of 9 now.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
What? 7 of 9? That's a Borg designation, isn't it? My name is 7 of 9. And she's not backing off of this. So they reissue her documents, which say Annika Hansen, which she looks at and she doesn't recognize the name, but this is what she's got as her permanent resident card. So they've dead named her, and there's nothing she can do to get the ID fixed. And it's sort of similar to, you know, a few years ago, maybe it actually might be a while now. Maybe it was back during the Obama years. There was some guy, American citizen, he went off, he allied himself with ISIS, and he changed his name to some sort of, you know, Arabic war name, whatever, to sort of show his shift in allegiance. He gave up his sort of American identity and adopted this different identity to show that he had allied himself with ISIS. They stripped his citizenship. Mm. They took away his American citizenship and declared him a valid enemy target. Well, that's similar to what it's not as severe, but that's sort of what the Federation is doing here. They're like, let me get this straight. You want to keep your Borg designation, but you want to apply for Federation citizenship. You are taking a name which shows your allegiance to and connection with our most dangerous avowed enemy, who Janeway just blew up their transwarp hub. And if they do come looking for trouble, they're going to be mighty pissed.
Right.
You want to be 7 of 9, but you also want a Starfleet commission. Mm-hmm. So she's getting a lot of pushback. She's facing a lot of fear. She's facing a lot of racism. She's not getting a warm welcome on Earth. And she finally reaches, you know, the conclusion Janeway is going to go to the wall and ruin her career fighting for Seven's opportunities here. And that's never going to fly. And so Seven realizes, you know, partly she's just feeling embarrassed. She's feeling humiliated. She's feeling shut out. She's feeling rejected. And she's afraid, and rightfully so. And she's also angry. That's part of what destroys her relationship with Chakotay, is the fact that he gets to go off to this great new Starfleet assignment, but it's top secret. He's on the Protostar, according to Prodigy. There's no way Starfleet is letting Seven anywhere near that ship.
Right.
She can't go aboard that ship. She can't even know the name of the ship. She lets all that, as she says in the book, she lets the anger, the envy, the resentment that comes from that, and she uses that, and she sabotages that relationship, which is why she's not with him at the start of the book. And she has to go find herself. And what we have here is a classic Bildungsroman, which is the German term for a coming of age tale. Mm-hmm. And it follows all the classic beats. She's got to leave home. She's got to cut that figurative, metaphorical apron string that connects her to Janeway. She's got to leave. She's got to go out on her own into the universe. She's got to make her own way, figure out how to be an independent adult. But now she's also got an additional level of problems, which is she's 32 years old. She is beginning to figure out that she's queer, but she has no idea how to live as an adult queer woman on her own. And she's going to have to figure it out on the fly, because all the years when she should have been figuring out who the hell she is, the Borg robbed her of not only her childhood, but her adolescence and her young adulthood. All the years that we all take for granted when we figured out who we are who we're attracted to, what we want to do in life, where do our talents lie, what do we believe in. We had decades to figure these things out, and all that time was stolen from her. So now she's trying to figure all that out at the age of 32 while also separating from the only emotional support network she's ever known. And she's dealing, you know, with all sorts of other things. So the book is essentially, it's about the journey of self-discovery. It's about Seven figuring out who she is, who she wants to be. At the beginning of the book, she wants this Starfleet commission. She wants her Federation citizenship. But what does she really want? What does she really need? It's not the Starfleet commission. It's not even the Federation citizenship. What she needs is to feel accepted. She needs to feel wanted. She needs to feel safe. That's what she needs. She's thinking that what she wants is what Janeway has told her she should want. Starfleet, Federation. But what she needs is something more primal, something more basic. And that's what she's going to find in the Fenris Rangers. And much of what's going on in the story is that it's an allegory for queer identity, where she's actually queer. That's not supposed to be a big deal anymore at this point in the Star Trek universe. But she's facing bigotry of another kind. And it's because she's visibly different because of her implants. She is different, visibly so, in a way that it makes it dangerous for her to live openly. And so that and the fact that she's dealing with dead naming issues are also an allegory for trans identity and trans issues, which are now sadly growing in intensity and danger level here in the United States. So her story is also in that respect. It's a story about being queer. It's about being trans. It's about daring to be different and then standing up for your identity, as she does at the end of the book, where she finally realizes, I can't change the fact that I'm ex-Borg. This is physically part of who I am. It can't be removed without killing me. So in that respect, that's the allegory for the queer side of her her nature. And then the fact of her name, where she tells someone at the end of the book, you know, this person who's just been through the whole book, and she finally gets him, you know, and has the upper hand. She says, and I will never, ever again be told that I don't know my own fucking name.
And very it's good.
It's like, I'm hoping that's the fist pump moment where every queer or trans reader who gets to read this book will just go, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I do hope a lot of people read the book, because it really, it is, does, it's a good book.
Well, thank you. It's very kind.
Yes. Yes. Well, so what are you working on now, if you can tell us or hint at?
I've got a bunch of short fiction that'll be coming out in the Star Trek Explorer magazine over the next few months throughout 2024. I have four stories scheduled. The first one will drop in issue 11, which I think is coming out on April 2nd here in the U.S. And then there should be stories following either in the print magazine or in the digital supplement. Issues 12, 13, and 14. I just turned in the last of those. I have a couple of original short stories that should be out in anthologies, I think this fall. One is in an anthology called Combat Monsters of World War II. That's coming from Blackstone Press, edited by Henry Hertz. And the concept essentially is real battles or events of World War II, but with some sort of supernatural monster, creature, mythological being, or whatever, inserted into the story in some way. And the story I did for that is called Bockscar, B-O-C-K-S-C-A-R. And for those who don't recognize the name, that's the name of the aircraft that dropped the second atomic bomb when we dropped that Nagasaki.
Okay.
So I wrote a story about that aircraft and that crew. And it's actually based on the real crew who flew the real plane and the real mission. Then it adds the monster element and kind of goes off in another direction. Then the other one that's coming out is part of a space Western anthology by an editor named David Boop. That'll be out through Bain. I believe it's called The Last Train Out of Kepler 283C or something to that effect. It's the third of these space Western anthologies that he's done. And I'm happy with the story I did for that, which is called Living by the Sword. And that's, I'll let people discover that one on their own, but I'm very happy with how that turned out. In terms of other things I've got going on, I'm in limbo. I'm waiting to hear about a project that I was hired for, that I'm working on sort of on the QT. I don't know if it's going forward. I'm just going to have to wait. I'm working on it with Kirsten Beyer, and we're dealing with a lot of internal politics and other matters at Secret Hideout. Hopefully that'll get a green light, and I'll work on that later this year. I'm working on some pages for an original novel that maybe my agent will find a home for. Well, that's what I'm doing.
That's a lot.
You're not bored, are you?
The short stories are all done. The script project is on hold. So right now what I'm doing is I'm basically noodling and trying to put together a proposal for a new original novel, a contemporary fantasy piece.
Very good.
So not Star Trek, just an original standalone.
Although I do want to do more Star Trek books. I am hoping that if it's at all possible, when they do start acquiring titles for 2025 and beyond, I don't know yet, but I've told the editors I would really love to get my hands on a Strange New Worlds book.
Excellent.
Please.
Neat.
Please, sir. May I have another?
That's awesome. Do you have any plans? So I know sometimes you appear at conventions on panels and such. Very rarely.
Yes.
So it's interesting because
COVID wiped out my con schedule. And over the last few years, I discovered I really don't miss it.
Okay.
The only con I've been making a point to get back to, and I will be back there this year, is a con in the Maryland area called Shoreleave.
Shore Leave, yeah. But it's in Pennsylvania this year.
It moved to Lancaster because the Hunt Valley Inn, sadly, after 40 years, was sold and is being demolished. And it got sold for real estate. So, yes, the con Shore Leave is going to be this year. Last weekend in July, which sadly is the same weekend as Comic-Con International in San Diego. Because, you know, we needed that competition. And it's moving to a new venue, Lancaster. But my wife is very excited about that because Lancaster is where you go if you want to buy quilting fabric. And she loves quilting.
Okay.
Not to mention antique. I'm excited because there's a Friendly's restaurant, a very short drive from the hotel. And I want to go and get a Jim Dandy Sunday.
Nice. So,
awesome. So I'm excited too. I will see you there.
We all have our priorities.
So I'll definitely see you there because I'm there too.
That'd be great.
I'm usually, even though I'm an author, I'm usually at these conventions on the science track. I'm usually giving science things and then doing my author signings and such too. So that's why I was at Shore Leave last year, but on the science track.
But so you'll be part of the Friday night signing event, right?
I will be there.
See you there.
And the best thing about that weekend too is that's my 50th birthday weekend.
Wow.
Which I chose to spend at a convention.
Well, that'll be fun. We'll have to salute you.
Yep. It's gonna be awesome. But cool. So I'm glad we'll get to see you out and folks will get to see your book and get your book signed and everything.
That'd be terrific.
And well, does anyone else have any last questions they wanted to ask?
Sure. What is your favorite science fiction film? Doesn't have to be Star Trek. If it is, that's fine.
What would you say? I do love quite a number of them, but
is there that one that you could say I could sit and watch it every other day?
Blade Runner.
The original Blade Runner, 1982. Although I do like the final cut version more than the original theatrical.
Okay.
Solo. It's not Han Solo that Harper reminds me of.
Old Decker from Blade Runner 2049.
That makes more sense.
By Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you for that answer. Cool.
You're welcome.
Okay. David, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been great. Great. And again, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your insight with us and our listeners. And I just want to say to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning into the Big Sci-Fi Podcast. As always, if you want to interact and chat with us, join our Facebook group or find us on Instagram and Twitter, or you can always drop us a note at thebigscifipodcast@gmail.com. We also have to give a shout out to the Trek Geeks Podcast Network. We are proud to be part of the Trek Geeks Network. And remember that you will find some of us and our fellow podcasts at Trek Long Island at the end of May, beginning of June. So if you don't have your tickets, get your tickets now. So until we meet again, everybody, remember to extend kindness and understanding to everyone across the cosmos. Live long and prosper, and join us once more for our next cosmic journey on the Big Sci-Fi Podcast.
Coconut!